Welcome to Sundial. I'm Carlos Frias. Hanif Abdurraqib is more than one thing. He's the poet Hanif Abdurraqib. His poetry reflects on music and love and prayer and sneakers. He's the journalist Hanif Abdurraqib. One day he publishes an essay in The New Yorker about musician Mark Anthony Thompson and his cult classic album Black Music, an album that's pretty mind-blowing if you, like me, had never heard it. Another day, he's writing in the Smithsonian magazine about singer Marian Anderson, who sang in front of an integrated audience for Eleanor Roosevelt. He's the author, Hanif Abdurraqib. His first book of essays, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, was named a Book of the Year by many when it came out in 2017. Two of his latest books were nominated for the National Book Award. His latest, A Little Devil in America, published in 2021. Oh, and he's the genius, Hanif Abdurraqib. He won a MacArthur Fellowship, the Genius Grant. Hanif's in Miami for the opening night of O Miami's annual poetry festival. He'll be in conversation with the festival's founder Saturday at the Lyric Theater in Overtown. Welcome, Hanif.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a really delight to be here and talk to you.
You know, you're a man who clearly can talk about a lot of things, and I want to talk about a lot of those things, Black excellence, and music, and poetry, and history. So let's start with the most important topic. What sneakers are you wearing right now?
Well, now I have on my running shoes, because after this I'm going on a run, so right now I have on my Brooks running shoes. But yesterday, which is the most, because I was traveling and I did a reading, had on the Jordan 4 White Cement Interscope Records pair, which is a pair that the Jordan brand gifted to Interscope Records musicians and employees of the label. And I was sent a pair of those a few years back, and I don't break them out a lot because they're kind of a special pair, but I was on the road and doing the reading, and I thought I should put on some nice sneakers. So that's what I had on yesterday. But as of now, I just have on a pair of boring, torn up running shoes. It's about 58 degrees in Columbus right now, so I'm going to try to get out and get some road miles in.
Well, yeah, Scott Cunningham, who's the founder of O Miami, was telling me, make sure you ask Hanif about sneakers, because, you get to a point where you become big enough and they start sending you all kinds of crazy stuff. And he's like, he admitted he became a sneakerhead over the pandemic.
Yeah, well, I mean, Scott, I feel like Scott and some of my other friends, I'm maybe a bad influence on, because, I think some of my sneaker enthusiast tendencies have rubbed off on some of my pals, which is great to see. But I also feel a slight bit of guilt because, it's easy for me to fall into this, I've been a sneaker guy for now, like, over a decade. But, I'm also the only real responsibility I have in my life is taking care of my dog Wendy, and so for my friends with larger responsibilities in the world, I sometimes worry that I steered them on the wrong path.
All right, yeah, you put them on a very dangerous path here. I mean, and it's funny because I've read that when you were growing up, obviously your parents didn't have a lot of money, and I think about myself, like when Jordans first dropped, I think we're probably similar age-ish, whatever. And I remember the idea of paying $100 for a sneaker. Like I idolized Michael Jordan, but I wasn't even going to ask my parents about buying a pair of $100 sneakers. Now, and so it's like I'm wearing Jordans today, and I'm thinking, how far things have come. And I was wondering if you think about that ever, about like kind of like some small thing for you now that's like a small comfort of a thing that is so different from what your childhood was like.
Yeah, well, I mean, not even just my childhood, but I, much of my adult life, my late teens, early 20s, even mid 20s, were kind of spent in precarious situations. I was unhoused for a bit. I, did not have access to a lot. And so, for me, their comforts and just kind of sneakers are kind of a silly and frivolous thing that I enjoy, but silly and frivolous nonetheless. But for me, there's kind of just comforts in legitimately being able to kind of cook a meal. I'm not by no means am I a great cook, but I take great pleasure in these small things that were for a long time inaccessible to me. and or that felt like when they were not as accessible to me, they felt like singular delights, and I try to carry that over to the present day. I still really revel in the making of a meal. I still really revel in getting into bed after a long day. These kind of things that did not necessarily feel like they were guaranteed.
Right. And I was hearing you talk in an interview about, and you just kind of mentioned in the passing, like, your parents obviously were, it sounded like they were at points living paycheck to paycheck or what have you, and finding a set of basketball shoes by the door the day before tryouts. And I totally felt that, can you talk to me a little bit about, like, I mean, you're such an observer of culture and everything around you, and like let's stick with sneakers for a second. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what that was important to in the culture that you were growing up in Columbus, Ohio, and where you still live, right?
Yeah, still live in Columbus, still live on the east side of Columbus. It's interesting. I learned to love sneakers very much in my household first, in my neighborhood first. My oldest brother, I'm the youngest of four, and my oldest brother, who's about 10 years older than me, had a job, that he like worked at Wendy's. And for me as a kid to kind of watch him grind, and then he went to college, he had jobs in college. So he always kind of was up to date on sneakers. He had the pairs that were new, and he took good care of his sneakers too. But on my block, those were kind of the guys who like worked at the mall, who worked at Foot Locker. And so there are ways that sneakers were kind of a signifier, in a different way that they are now, I think. Or now when I go into high schools, where I spend some time in high schools, sneakers are kind of something that people are in awe of, but not really. I think everyone, the style is a bit more expansive. Like, kids are wearing Crocs to school, and which I wish that was the move when I was younger, because that would have been me.
You're a
But
slides guy.
now I am. Now I feel like if I'm just moving around my backyard or whatever. But like, when I was young, these were big signifiers of things. So I remember the first pair of sneakers I got on my own was a pair of black and red Jordan 13s. He Got Game came out. The movie He Got Game came out in 98 when I was like 15, and I snuck out of school to go see it with some friends, and I desperately wanted, the white, black, and red Jordan 13s that, that everyone was wearing in the movie. But by the time the movie had come out, those had been out already. So they had been out and sold out, and been hard to find. But the black and red ones were not as hard to access. And so I mowed lawns. It was like the beginning of spring, and I just mowed lawns for however long it took to get to earn the, at that point, I think, $110, to get that pair.
Man, that was some serious money. And you actually just with that with He Got Game, you just shouted out a huge a Miami hero, Ray Allen,
Yes,
playing Jesus
yes.
Shuttleworth. Yeah, for sure, one of the heroes
Yeah.
here. You
Ray
mentioned.
Allen, who now I just saw, made peace with Kevin Garnett, who was very not happy with him for
For leaving
leaving to come to
Miami.
Miami.
Yeah. I mean, he knew where the championship was going to be at, so.
He deserved. I mean, players chase titles. It's what they do. We all try to get a little bit closer to glory, sometimes the easiest path possible, and I don't fault anyone for that.
You mentioned your brother. Was he a role model for you?
One of them. Yeah, I do think, growing up the youngest of four was really great for me, in part because, I grew up in a household where everyone was listening to music all the time. And everyone was kind of listening to different music. My parents had music tastes that were separate from each other. My siblings had music tastes that were kind of aligned but separate. And that came up in the era of college radio exploding again. And I grew up in a college town. And so, my sister was into Riot Girl and punk and alternative music, and my brother was into metal, and we were all into hip hop. And so I got to kind of be an audience to a really robust set of music tastes.
That
That is what being the youngest granted me. Yeah.
yeah, I was gonna say that clearly had an effect on you to be able to be exposed to that wide range of music.
Yeah, it was also good because, to gain entry, like, not saying that I was neglected by any means, but when you're the youngest, it's sometimes hard to have your say, in the ecosystem, particularly the youngest of four, where there are many voices in the ecosystem. And to kind of gain entry to the worlds I wanted to be in, I had to express or show some level of proficiency, cultural proficiency. And
Oh, so
so,
you had to know something to be able to join the conversation. I
You know,
gotcha.
so I took to that seriously. I took to that task seriously, and learning about music and understanding music at an early age was just massively important in my household.
And obviously you comment so much on music and it's played so much of a role in your work. Did you play music growing up at all?
Well, I tried. I was bad. I was a very bad trumpet player. Like very, very bad. I didn't, well, you know, the problem is, in order to get good at something, you got to practice. And I really was resistant to practice. So
You mean your
I,
parents weren't excited about you playing the trumpet badly at home?
no, I mean, well, they wanted me to get better. I think my father was exceedingly disappointed at my not taking it too seriously. And so no, I was, you know, I was a bad trumpet player. I play some piano now. I kind of picked that up on my own, and I play some keys, but also that I don't do extremely well, but I do it better than I play trumpet.
Can you draw a line between the music you grew up hearing and being exposed to music like that to wanting to say something about it with your work?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it goes back to my brain is kind of, when it comes to music, my brain is, it trends towards the analytical, because I had to analyze music to get into the, I had to nudge my way into the conversation somehow. And it actually, I think often about being in like middle school and having music conversations on the bus, for example, and realizing really quickly that my proficiency or my ability to talk about music was different than my peers,
Oh,
significantly different.
in what way?
Where like I at a very young age, I could identify, you know, like key changes or you know, the kind of musical nuance that exists on an album like Pet Sounds, for example. The Beach Boys album Pet Sounds. These kind of things. And I was never like shunned for that, to be clear. It was always both in my household and in the world that I was in outside of it. I think that that was really accepted and welcomed and exciting, and you know, for me. And I had a lot of friends who were equally as into music as I was, very, very different music than I was, but we were all kind of into music in the same ways. But I just realized I was able to talk about it in significantly differently. And there's a lot. I mean, I owe my family a great degree for that, because they were not, there was kind of no judgment placed on the kind of enthusiasm that I think in some other households might be seen as strange or off-putting, or you know, you're just kind of like the young weirdo who's got these obsessions. But I think I was really placed in a family where my obsessions were, you know, heard out, where they were catered to, where there was a real generosity around the attention paid to them.
You could really nerd out on music and everybody was cool with it and they encouraged it, which is great.
Yeah, because that's, you know, everyone in the house was also nerding out on music. Yeah.
Nice. Do you think that analytical nature is that, can you also then push that a step forward and say, like, this is why poetry was interesting to you and
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I think if I did the real work of analyzing it, probably, but the real easiest answer about that is poetry was something I did out of what I believed was necessity. I was a music critic first. I was writing album reviews for local and regional newspapers, back when those existed in a robust form, and
Sure.
now they do not.
Right.
And editors at these publications would kind of be down on my work a bit. They would say it's too poetic and too meandering. And I didn't study poetry. I have no quote unquote formal education in poetry, so I didn't know what that meant. And so I just, this is around 2011, 2012, I just wanted to read poems and figure out how to kind of use this what some were calling poetic to my advantage. And so I kind of built an MFA or a poetry practice study for myself, where I just got a lot of books and I sat in my room and read, and I took notes and I highlighted things, and I eventually started writing some poems on my own and built from there. But undoubtedly, so there is an analytical nature to that approach and the curiosity of that approach that has served me. But really, I was drawn to writing poems because I figured if no one's going to hire me to write music reviews anymore, I want to write something. And that was the something.
Who brought poetry into your life? Like it's who really opened your eyes to that form at all?
And it was mostly, I will say that the initial spark of it was mostly me. But a funny thing is, I was asked to host a poetry night in 2011 because there was this coffee shop in Columbus that I was writing in all the time. And they were like, "Well, we want to start a poetry night, and you're always in here writing. We don't know what you're writing, but you write, so will you do it?" And I hadn't written a poem at that point, but I was like, "Sure, yeah, whatever,
That is
do
hilarious.
this
You
thing."
had the look of a poet.
Yeah, but I wasn't writing poems, perhaps. I was like probably not writing much of anything at all, but that was the start. And I did this thing that I will say I did have poetry mentors who guided me along the way. The poet Scott Woods and the poet Will Evans here in Columbus, Ohio, were immensely important to me. But slash and I a lot of it was drawn from the same thing I used to do as a kid, which was the reading of liner notes. And so the first poetry book I ever got was Gabby Calvo-Caressi's The Last Time I Saw Amelia Earhart. And I loved it. And so I scrolled to the back of the book and I read the acknowledgments. And anytime a poet was thanked, I circled that poet's name. And then I went to go get their books, as many as I could, from the library, or if I had a little cash, go to a used bookstore. And then I would just repeat that process. I would read a book. If I liked it, I would go back to the acknowledgments. And I would read all the poets that were thanked, and then I would go find the books. And so I created this kind of this lineage for myself that worked. I mean, it to some degree, I think it worked really well.
Yeah, well, I would say so. I'd say in a year's time, you went from writing your first poem to winning a Genius Grant, a MacArthur Fellowship. So I want to pick up on that, but I got to take a little bit of a break. We're speaking with Hanif Abdurraqib, who's an award-winning poet, essayist, and cultural critic, and he's going to be in town for opening night of O Miami. We'll be back on Sundial in a minute after this break. We're back on Sundial. This is Carlos Frias, and our guest today is the poet, writer, cultural critic, Hanif Abdurraqib. Hanif, so you first started writing poetry in 2011. Like I said, and by 2021, you win a Genius Grant. And your books, two of your last three books, were National Book Award nominees. It seems like you had this readiness, this furious readiness to start expressing yourself. Can you talk about that, about kind of trusting that voice inside of you to start commenting in music but also adding your own voice and your own commentary?
But yeah, I mean, surely there's some trust at the bottom of the pile, but I think what most rises to the top is just an exuberance and an excitement for music that I felt. I didn't really care if anyone read anything I was writing. I just wanted to get the things that I was feeling and obsessed about somewhere beyond my head, so that I could make room for her. Further obsessions. Every time I get to extract something, I get to build a container for something else. And through the act of extraction, sometimes writing that comes out that is also exciting to me. But I was early on, I was never writing to be read. And I still don't think I really do. I mostly write to get to not even the end point of an obsession, but a secondary point of an obsession where
Move it
I'm
along,
raised
move it
move it
forward.
along. Yeah, right, like move it forward, right. And so undoubtedly there's a trust there, but I don't know even how much I trust myself as a writer. I trust myself as someone who believes that music has really had a massive impact on my life and the lives of people I love and know. And that does not happen just because it's an idle art form, and doesn't happen because it's a trivial art form. And so I want to breathe some life and seriousness into an art form that matters a great deal to me. And I think that's kind of, that's kind of where I'm at.
Can you talk about this thing you mentioned in a New Yorker essay, where you used to go to these listening pods in Columbus, right? Like at the library, and you would just kind of lose yourself in music. Can you talk about that a little bit, about how that lets you kind of explore music and think deeper about it?
Yeah. It's funny because as I was writing that piece, I was like, man, does this still exist now? You know, are these still in libraries now? And I couldn't figure it out. I don't think they do, but so it was one of those things where I was like, I don't know how I'd explain this to someone. But yeah, you could just go to the library and listen to albums, and no one would kick you out. It was like, you know, no one would. And the great thing about this, at least for me when I was a kid, is that the albums, you're at the discretion of whoever was working at the library.
Oh, so they're acting like DJ for you, or deciding what they're going to give you?
Yeah, they would put some different albums in the rotation, and you would have to just kind of be at the mercy of whatever they put there. But that was a real generous point of discovery for me, because that is also the kind of listener I am right now, where very much I'm kind of eager to sit down and see what else someone else has curated that they're excited about that I might not be privy to. And so there's a way that that also expanded my curiosity around music and around what music's capable of.
I'm thinking about musicians in South Florida, because so much music, especially, is like, there's always shout outs to Miami and call outs to Miami and you know, Miami rappers referenced and what have you. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen in your work about, and your interest and your study about how Miami plays into like the larger music scene?
Oh yeah, I mean, Miami is, I think for me, pretty vital. It's funny because my first relationship with Miami music was Two Live Crew, because
the world,
because of the level of controversy, yeah, the world famous Two Live Crew,
right? As a background for folks who have lived under the rock during the '90s, like their album was considered obscene by some people in government, and they tried to ban it, and they tried to arrest them on stage, and it eventually became a Supreme Court case, and it's why we have the little labels on all music about explicit lyrics or what have you. So that made an impression on you then, obviously.
That made it, yeah. But then you do more history, you know, like what I love about Miami is not just a hub for brilliant musicians, but also a lot of great albums have been recorded there. So if you look at like what was being done with Criteria Studios, you know, like Rumors was recorded there. Mm-hmm. I think Hotel California was recorded there. And then there's like TK Records, which has this massive relationship with like Betty Wright and Casey and the Sunshine Band,
you named the artist. My cousin was a studio musician and studio engineer, and they had like Cher come in and record a song.
I mean, Miami's a hub. I mean, Tom Dowd was working out of Miami who's like an innovative engineer, was working out of Miami for like decades, and like Ray Charles was coming down and Aretha's coming down. But also, like, there's when disco was being derided, Miami was really kind of still on the forefront of pushing really good disco forward. And I thought, you know, that was great. And I mean, I could keep going. You know, my mother really loved Gloria Estefan. My mother really loved the Miami Sound Machine. And so that was like another early, early example of music that was huge for me. But yeah, I'd go on. I mean, I think Miami has a legacy that people tie to it in terms of its hip hop influence, which is great. But some of the actual thinking about Miami as a recording hub for music and a place where people could come to record good albums, it just has a really rich history of albums that were crafted there. And I think that's important.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's the people, is the technical nature of it? Was it just because like, you can clear your brain and be on the beach or something?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some people who prefer, you know, people have their studio preferences. Some people like the kind of Electric Lady thing in New York, because it's, you know, the sounds of the city can expand someone's sound palette. Some people like the coast. Some people love being on a beach. But also, Miami is just kind of where, at one point, a lot of innovation was happening technologically. and a lot of innovators were living there. And you kind of just go, you go where the best people are working. At some point, you just got to go where the best people are working.
Right.
And I think that's a part of it too.
It reminds me of a conversation I was having with Scott Cunningham, the founder of Miami, and he said something once that we talked about, which is that Miami is hardwired for poetry. The idea that, people are walking around living these poems and they don't realize it, And do you feel like there's an element of that? Live in a place that's kind of multicultural and interesting and hot and that puts people in a kind of a poetic place?
Yeah, and I generally also think that if you can be outside a lot of the year, I think that helps. And if you are, I mean, like really, to be real, I mean, if you're in a place that is, or is there's a level of peril too, because if you think about Miami in climate, in the shifting climate, and how that will impact the landscape, there's a way that you are also like living in awareness of that, which is not wonderful, but is also I think a point of that is also a poetic entry point.
Speaking of that, music is so important for you, and you realize you kind of teach yourself poetry. You have this self-inspired MFA, and you begin to cross those things, right? And you add a little journalism, and you sprinkle in some study of history, and that's at the root of your last book, basically. You're studying history and Black performances, and tell me about how you got to that point where you begin to cross those things together.
I mean, it's very natural to me, I think. It's kind of just where my brain automatically goes. Like I think it's just the easiest and most effective way to express my obsessions and excitements is through the pursuit of beautiful language and through the pursuit of the poetic form, so to speak, which I think draws people in and can ask a reader to bring their most generous self to the page. And once you get a reader there to that point, to that level of eagerness, I think you kind of do whatever you want, not irresponsibly, but I mean, in terms of storytelling, in terms of saying, well, now I'm going to tell you why we're here, and I hope you'll stick around for a bit.
Right at
So
that point,
that's,
they start trusting you when they start giving
yeah.
you a chance to go beyond clearing your throat, right?
Right. It's a question of trust. It's always going to be a question of trust in, how to make something out of what in my head, as in its rawest form, is kind of just a cluster of disparate ideas.
Talk to me about some of your influences that go beyond poetry. I heard you mention that Toni Morrison was a big
Yeah.
inspiration, and we're obviously dealing with book bans here in Florida, and The Bluest Eye was on one of those lists and what have you. And talk to me about her as an inspiration for you and what her writing did for you.
Yeah, Toni Morrison's a massive, massive influence for me. I'm a big Toni Morrison disciple, not just her writing, but also her practice of editing and her practice of trying to broaden the landscape of Black writing in America to which she did before she kind of got in her own writing. But she also was so good at rejecting the idea of kind of singular genius. And I think that is also, I know I'm talking about so much beyond her actual work, but these are big influence points for me too, where you look at someone like Toni Morrison, who was brilliant, but was always eager to say, but I'm not the only one. Because I think she knew that when you, particularly with Black genius, when you kind of reduce it to this single thing of there's only one or there's there or it's rare, that's a real enemy to kind of accountability and to an ecosystem where we all uplift and push each other to get better. And her work aside, of which I love deeply, I also love the way she carried herself in the world as a writer who believed in other writers, as a writer who felt that we that Black writers specifically had had work to do in terms of uplifting each other and tying on tying ourselves to each other in a lineage that is useful, not just for us, but for whatever future generations may find our way.
Well, so much of your work, especially in your last book that you talked about, was about breaking the idea of that monolith, like we are all this one thing. And I was talking with Orrin Squire, a writer, yesterday about how you go to different parts of the country and they see you as Hispanic and they might just lump that into a category. And I wonder how much has that played into your work, is kind of like really specifying all the different, like breaking that idea of the monolith.
Yeah, well, I think that for me it's easy, because for me it's easy because I think the way my brain works and the way that I was growing up, I just saw so many different types of Black folks. I mean, I think sometimes it's maybe as simple for me as I grew up around a lot of different Black folks, and so I never really thought anything about. It's never been challenging for me to reach for the kind of expansive nature of blackness because that's just what I was exposed to. And it shows up in my work, I think, with some level of ease because that's just what it has been always. And so I almost don't know any other way. When I think about the punk music that I was exposed to, for example, or punk scene I was on, that was mostly. Other Black kids like me, I was exposed to punk through other Black kids. And so I was never made to feel like any kind of outsider due to what I was or wasn't listening to or what I was or wasn't doing.
Hanif, I have to take a break here, but when we come back, will you read a little bit of your poetry for us?
Yes, I
Okay.
will.
Okay. We're speaking with Hanif Abdurraqib. He's an award-winning poet, essayist, and cultural critic. He'll be in town for O Miami's opening night, and he'll be reading some poetry to us when we come back on Sundial. We're back on Sundial. This is Carlos Frias, and our guest today is the poet Hanif Abdurraqib. Hanif's going to be in town for O Miami's opening night, Saturday, April 1st, at the Black Archives. Hanif, so you're kind enough to choose a poem that you're going to read and give us a little bit of a preview. Will you tell us a little bit about what you're going to read?
Yeah, I was at first going to read something from a little bit of America, but I think I'm going to read a new poem or a newer poem. And
Oh,
this is
wow.
maybe a good example of being in between genres, so to speak. This is a poem. People often ask me, like, how do you know what's a poem or what's an essay? And there's like a technical, somewhat boring answer to that. But I think a better answer for me is that sometimes I don't know until it's in process. This is a poem that I extracted from a new book I'm working on because, or I extracted this idea from a new book I'm working on because it just didn't fit in the book itself, and I made it into a poem. And it's born out of me repeatedly watching one moment from the Notorious B.I.G.'s funeral. I oftentimes think about returning to the site of. Recite the sight of something, returning to a moment or returning to place and just turning it over in my hands multiple times. And so there was a scene in the Notorious B.I.G.'s funeral where these birds flew over a car full of roses. And I was intrigued by that. And I spent a lot of time, watching it and watching it and watching it. And then I wrote this poem. So this is called, this is one of those situations where the title is the first line. So watching the notorious B.I.G.'s funeral procession for the 17th time, I can't help but notice the white wings of the dove and its aimless twirling above the black whips pouring slow down the block and the wrists occasionally flung from their tinted windows, white diamonds ascending towards the off-white sky. And in a moment, no longer than the exit of a half-drawn breath, the dove finds itself above a car with its trunk open and overrun with a chorus of soft white roses. And it is here, I swear. I cannot tell where the feathers end and the petals begin, to say nothing of the clouds, which in this joyous exhale of a second are delighting in the marriage of all this fluorescent white. high stepping down the aisles and locking fingers with the smoke blowing from the mouths of black folks bouncing atop the cop cars and shaking the fences of the check cashing spot. There are the graves we do not dance upon, but they are certainly not these. And there are the two black boys dangling out of a high rise window, their mouths open wide and dark as solar systems, their hands pointing in awe at this confluence of small and clumsy heavens, stumbling towards one another, perhaps as in awe as I am now, or as I was then, when the dope boys came back to the block in summer, and their white car doors flung towards the sky, a fleet of divine hunting birds lined up along the basketball courts, Biggie's voice pummeling the wall of humid air. The song says, somebody gotta die, but doesn't say who, doesn't say where, doesn't name the street people will push their closed fists into while the wheels of a hearse stumble along a plague of potholes. The song suggests death as necessity. Be grateful there is still enough earth to be buried under and a set of hands that might love you enough to do the digging. The casket weighs the same no matter who rests inside of it. I propose death itself is the weight, which is what you might say to me now, to make sense of why I cannot lift the box that holds what is left of your ashes, but easily raised you on my shoulders when we are young and light as feathers, stretching up towards the branches and taking what we could from abandoned nests.
Wow. That was Hanif Abdurraqib. Literally, somebody in the next room just went, woo, because it is. It was like, it was this eulogy, but it was also this hot fire that you gave us right here.
Thanks. Thank you.
Tell me where you were when you witnessed that.
Well, the first time, so that was me watching like a video of it, yeah, on YouTube, because you watch on YouTube. But I actually recently wrote about Biggie's death, and I wrote about it, I think, in A Little Devil in America too, because it was one of those where I talked about being the youngest and having to like find my way to get entry points into conversations. When Biggie was killed, I remember it vividly because the news happened on a Friday, early Saturday morning, you know, after midnight in LA. I remember getting up very early on a Saturday morning because it was one of the rare times in my house where we had cable. We didn't always have cable. And I was like, I'm gonna get up really early and watch all the cartoons, you know? And I remember getting up very early and flipping through the channels, and I flipped on MTV right as, you know, Friday nights, if we had cable, my brothers would stay up and we would watch UMTV Raps and Headbangers Ball and all that. So when I turned on the TV, it was still on MTV. And it turned it on right before Kurt Loder came and gave the special report that Biggie was killed. And this was like 8 a.m. in Columbus. And no one else was awake. And so there was this moment where I had this information that no one else in my house or my orbit had. And I remember just waiting, you know, like I wanted to wake someone up and give them the news. And I remember just, this was before like smartphones. So, you know, you can't like roll over in bed. And I remember just like waiting for one of my brothers to wake up so that I could be the person to, you know, kind of have my own breaking news moment.
Right. Like, what do I do? What do I do with this information that feels like I'm the only person in the world that has it right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did your brothers receive that information? Do you remember waking them, shaking them out of bed, or waiting until they get up?
I waited until they woke up, and I feel like if I recall, I don't think either of them believed me. You know, it was one of those things where they had to like, you know, eventually they turned on the news. MTV was doing like a full day memorial tribute kind of thing. I mean, you know, Biggie was murdered right before his second album came out, and I think it was one of those things where. It took over kind of the whole news cycle of a day, but for me delivering the news, I don't think they believed it.
How much did that event, do you think, I don't know, shape your worldview about music or about culture or how those things interact?
Well, it concerned me a lot because I loved hip hop. And by that point, There was a point in time, you know, hip hop had already kind of gone through a couple different eras of moral panic in America in the late 80s, again in the early 90s. But this time, because there were these two back-to-back murders, Biggie and Tupac, the moral panic trended towards this idea of this is an unsustainable genre, or this is a genre that simply cannot, will not exist, right?
Like if it's built on our favorite rappers killing each other, then this is not a sustainable model.
Yeah, and that worried me. That scared me when I was a kid because I loved it, and there was a fear that, you know, it wouldn't be. You know, I didn't know. You're 12, 13 years old, and you're like watching the panic on the news. You know, you're kind of watching the moral panics on the news. I thought it would be over. I thought all of the music and all the culture that was carrying the music would have ended. And of course, that didn't happen. But I do remember there were some months where I was really kind of afraid about that.
Yeah, I think if you were a kid, like I was a teenager when the whole Two Live Crew flap was here, and it's like you couldn't hear it on the radio, and then some people were defying anyway, and they were playing, and they're like, why does everybody hate this music that I'm listening to the point where they want to shut it down, you know? And I guess in this case, even other rappers, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, hip hop's kind of pivot to the hyper commercial in the months that followed had some. You know, I'm not all in favor of that, but there's a way that kind of placated the public.
How did you address that in your writing? Like, how did you try to say, don't let this pendulum swing all the other way? In other words, that's an acknowledgement, right? That this is all going very commercial and it doesn't feel as authentic. How did you try to acknowledge that?
Well, to me, you know, I think sometimes people are at the mercy of the landscape, and the landscape, I think, demanded a more commercial effort, if for nothing else, simply to placate those who would rather see the demise of the genre altogether. Now, the only problem with that is kind of once you start down that path of hyper-commercialization, it's pretty hard to turn away. And, you know, I think that broadly, some decisions were made around the work that I think did not perhaps serve the genre as well as I would like to see it serve. But that's also just kind of, you know, that's a part of what happens in these moments. And I think that what came out of that was an expansive, you know, hip hop got to be a bit more expansive. And that means that more people got into it who are maybe making groundbreaking music today.
You know, I want to switch a little bit gears here and ask you about your work and it being discovered in a way that, like, you know, you've already said that, you know, you kind of wrote for yourself. You never really wrote, like, you know, the idea of commercialization is what got me thinking about it, kind of writing for the masses. But then you write this work and kind of your first work out of the gate gets this great recognition. I mean, you've already been a New York Times bestseller, you know, being in the National Book Award conversation twice. Can you talk about a little bit about having your work discovered in a way that maybe you hadn't expected?
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't ever really, part of me doesn't really ever think about it like that, mostly because I think if I did, it would make it hard to continually create new work. But I have a lot of gratitude for, you know, like I started, my earliest writing was just writing in punk zines, you know, that no one, you know, like my friends would read, and that was about it. And so I have a lot of gratitude for any, you know, person who picks up my book and the way that my books have moved in the world, because it's one of those things that seems incredibly unlikely to me. It's one of those things that doesn't seem like it should be real. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Was there a moment like that where you're sitting in Columbus and you're like, these words that I've written here in my space here in my town are now being read everywhere? And like, did you have that terrifying moment to leave your house or just like the great realization of it?
I think it's more of a, yeah, it's a happy realization. It's a real happy realization. I mean, you know, that's how it always begins, though. All of our work begins somewhere. All of our work begins with a blank page and us somewhere in front of that blank page, and wherever we call home, or wherever we are making a home, or wherever we are making a space to write. And we don't ever know what the outcome of that becoming will be. And I think we're fortunate if the outcome of that is that the work moves through the world and touches anyone. But the becoming is what I'm most interested in. How to take where I am and take what I am obsessing about from my living room or my, on my runs through my neighborhoods and make it into something kind of tangible and tactile.
You're talking about your rents in your neighborhood, and it reminds me of this commentary you had once about nonverbal communication and walking down the street and having somebody like kind of nod at you, look at your sneakers, maybe look at your Jordans and nod at them, and that kind of thing. Talk to me a little bit about how you try to take something like that and make it into something that makes sense, beyond just a passing thought.
Because I think for me, it's the slowing down of a moment. So much, the way my brain works revolves around how can I resist the acceleration of a nuanced moment of connection, and understanding that these moments are not guaranteed, and understanding that these moments are, at least in my mind, to be taken seriously and be taken generously and thoughtfully. How can I resist the idea of passing over them to get to what some might believe is the larger point? How can I instead treat these tactile moments of interaction as the larger point? Someone nodding at you on the street and noticing you, someone affirming the fact that you have survived. These kind of things, it all goes back to, I think, my childhood and being kind of in a position where I had to notice these sonic nuances happening in music, and I had to kind of dig through music for my understanding of it in a real kind of magnifying glass kind of way, through that lens. And so that my approach is similar. I really want to kind of make a language in a pleasureful language out of these nuances.
Yeah. I think about you mentioned movement, a couple times, and I know for me, like when I'm stuck in writing, like I take my shoes off and I go walk in the grass. Like that's what does it for me. And you mentioned you're gonna go for a run in a minute here after the show ends. How much does that movement play in kind of loosening things up for you and letting you think and your creativity?
It's important to me now. It's funny. I played sports all my life. I played, basketball, and I played soccer in high school and college. And so much of movement in that regard, it's if you're a soccer player, it's like you are moving, but also your brain is processing what's going on at a rate that is, at least for me, it was like 10 times higher than how I was processing the world not on the pitch. And so what running is, I've been a runner for a while now, and running is so fascinating to me because it's not demanding, my brain is not demanded to process anything. And when you get a good groove, like I sometimes do, when you get into like a good runner's groove, really the work of the brain can be a little bit more flexible, and you can spend some time kind of immersed in whatever makes you forget about the physical activity,
I got you.
You're floating, and through that floating, you're processing whatever is on your mind as well. So yeah, I mean, I feel like now it's a real running for me is kind of where I get to twist the Rubik's cube of my obsessions around until some colors align.
All right. Well, in the last few seconds before we got to go, I have to ask you, I mean, if you're coming down to Miami, what sneakers are you going to be packing for your big show on? And bring it full circle for your big
Yeah.
presentation in Miami. What are you packing?
I don't know yet. It's good. It's going to be fascinating because for the past several readings I've had to do, I've had to pack like hoodies and stuff. And so they take up just more space in the bag. But for Miami, I get to pack a couple t-shirts. So there's going to be more room in the bag, which means I'll probably wear some like mid-cut shoes. I've been packing like low-cut joints because of the space. But now, I have a pair of Jordan 11s. I have these like, these pink snakeskin OVO Jordan 11s that I've been trying to wear somewhere outside the city. And so I'll probably pack those. But also, I will always bring like a trusted black shoe. So I'm probably going to bring like a black pair. But I don't know. I haven't, it's been so long since I've gone through my t-shirts because it has not been t-shirt weather anywhere I've been. And so I feel like when I start picking through I'm a big vintage music t-shirt collector, and I feel like when I start picking through and figuring out which ones I can pull out of storage and pack for the Miami trip, the sneakers will illuminate themselves as well.
Well, Hanif, we'll all be looking at your feet. We've spoke with Hanif Abdurraqib. He's a poet who will be in town for Oh Miami's launch on Saturday. Thank you so much, Hanif, for your time. And that sundial for Tuesday, March 28th. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band, Palo. Coming up tomorrow on the program, two South Florida artists. I'm Carlos Frias. Thanks for listening.